Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, seaweed. We get lots of questions about using seaweed in your compost and on your garden. And we'll supply some definitive answers for a change. Otherwise, it's a mostly phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're going to hop right to your questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Brian, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Mike, happy to be on the show. Long-time listener, first-time caller. How are you?
I am great, Brian. Thank you very much. Where are you, man?
I am in lovely Kutztown, Pennsylvania, just down the road from the college.
Oh, yeah, Kutztown. Ring baloney once, ring baloney twice. Kutztown, Kutztown. Ain't that nice? That is your school song, isn't it? Yeah.
Something like that. Generally, I was expecting to hear the clip-clop of hooves in the background.
What can we do for you?
I had purchased a jade plant from one of our, let's just call them a big box retailer, home improvement store, and bought it about 10 years ago when I was going to school in Kutztown, coincidentally, and did just let it grow. I had a little balcony, set it up there, and it thrived. It did really well. I would bring it in from winters, of course. Transplanted a couple times, larger pots here and there, and, you know, took cuttings as the years went on, and basically sprouted a flourishing jade plant arboretum and took over my living room for most winters. So
excellent.
I would be careful about drainage. You know, I've heard about, you know, the wet feet and the root rot with the succulents. You know, I wouldn't let it dry out completely in between waterings, but I would definitely let it get to the drier side. And when I would repot, I would crush up some terracotta and put it in the bottom of the new pot for proper drainage.
You did make a mistake, but it is a mistake that is more often recommended than warned against. 20 years ago, you couldn't read an article or a gardening book or watch somebody on TV who didn't fill the bottom of their pots with some sort of, like, nasty material, whether it was packing peanuts, broken up pots, marbles or something.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 90s, they did really specific studies that showed, because these containers are so small, so much smaller than the endless soil of the earth, plants don't want them down there. Plants don't want to hit rocks or peanuts or anything like that. They want a potting soil that has a lot of perlite or some other natural lightening material that's going to allow a lot of air in the soil, mixed well through the soil, but plants want soil all the way to the bottom of the drainage hole.
Well, I am guilty as charged, but I will absolutely use potting soil with more perlite to get the air in there. Now, the problem I have really specifically deals with, as the plant, let's call it the mother plant, got older, some of the stems, the trunks, whatever you want to call them, you know, as the plant got larger, it's probably about, you know, 3-4 foot in diameter. And the pot is probably a 2.5-3 foot diameter pot. Some of the trunks, and starting at the ends where the leaves and the branches were coming out, you know, the tips, they started to dry out. They started to shrivel up. And I noticed that the stems, the trunks, started to become sort of hollow and soft. And over time, they would dry out and basically, you know, with very little effort, just break off, revealing sort of a moldy,
I don't know
if I want to use the term mold, but it smelled musty. Half the plant is still surviving and doing great.
Mm-hmm.
The other half the plant has succumbed to this.
There's a couple of things that can go wrong. If the plant doesn't get enough sun during the summertime when it's outside, it can get leggy and misshapen. If it's underwatered, it can start to get brown, dry spots on what we'll call the leaves. If it gets overwatered, similar things can happen. But believe it or not, these jade plants that, you know, most people would put them in the bulletproof range, but they're really not. They require some care. They are prone to this disease. I'm not sure of the name. But when you said soft and rotten, that's an actual disease. And the biggest cause is lack of ventilation, lack of good airflow around the plant. They need more airflow than most houseplants. If they're in a very still, place this disease can get started, and it becomes systemic, as you've seen. It goes all throughout the plant, right?
Correct.
Have you ever seen these little clip-on plastic fans that people take?
Sure.
Yeah. Just clip that on to some nearby area and just keep air moving across the plants. They will go nuts. Now, if you want to try to save mama, get rid of anything that is soft, because that's a sign that it's 44% dead, and repot it into, and you know what I do is I actually buy bags of perlite. That's the only thing I really add anymore. I put compost on top of my raised beds. But if my raised beds seem to be getting a little heavy, I'll mix a lot of perlite into them. And whenever I use a potting soil or make up a potting soil, I'm up to half perlite in the mix now, because I've begun to understand how important it is to get air down in the soil. That's one of the really critical things. So, you know, find yourself some perlite. You'll never regret buying a small bag of it. It's totally organic. And really make that potting soil light. And if mama can be saved, fine. If not, there's always the children, which will, it sounds like now, with just this little added touch of good ventilation, you'll be able to grow to her size in a few years.
Mike, thank you very much for the tips. I'll go out and get a fan, and hopefully that does the trick for me.
I think it will. It sounds like you're doing a lot of things right. All right, you take care, man.
Yeah, you too. Have a nice time in Cuba.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Carlotta, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here, Carlotta. Where are you?
I am just outside of Raleigh.
In North Carolina?
Raleigh, North Carolina.
Okay.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Very good. That's a beautiful area, even in the wintertime, is my understanding.
Yes, it is. We are transplants here from Brunswick, Georgia. And we are liking it really well so far. We've been here about a year.
Yeah, but you moved from the south to the south, Carlotta. Now, if you had come down from Minnesota, that would be a different story.
True. That's true.
All right. We got to toughen you up at some point, move you up there to the far north. But for now, what can we do for Carlotta in North Carolina?
Well, I was looking for some expert advice because we recently purchased some land out just in Wake Forest, northeast of Raleigh here.
Right.
And it's virgin land. There had been some logging in there about 20, 25 years ago, but I would say it's 75% still hardwoods and great big tall pines also.
Right. Are you going to move there? Are you going to build a house there? Or did you buy a piece of property just to have another piece of property?
No. So we are going to build. We're wanting to put a log home there.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like possibly just after the new year, we'll start building the road and grooming the area to build the house, yes.
You're going to have somebody come in and remove trees so that the house can be built, right?
Right. Now, when at the time of putting in the driveway and the road and that will be a time to take out whatever trees to make my vegetable garden.
When the guys come out to key out the work, they have the mathematical skills to look at your trees and tell you where their shade line is going to be and their alignment. You know, mm-hmm. with east, west, north, and south is important, too. And that's where an expert can save you a lot of time and money and mistakes. They can come out.
Right.
They may use a sextant or whatever they use these days. And then they can calculate where the shade is going to go. Because don't forget, the shade is going to be variable over the course of a season. As we go through the different seasons, the sun's going to be in a different position. So they can compensate for that. And they'll be able to tell you exactly how far back you have to go to get the amount of sunlight that you want.
Yeah.
But after that, after they're all done and they regrade the land, for you to drop a foot-high raised bed frames over top and build a bunch of 4x8 raised beds, you'll be gardening before you're probably sleeping in that house. That's going to be the...
Oh, I would love that.
That's going to be the easy part.
I'm looking forward to that.
So
I think that would be great.
Here's the big picture advice. Make sure the trees are done correctly the first time, because you don't want to have these guys come out a second time. Get it all the work done at the same time. It'll be very cost effective. Build some raised beds. Depending on what kind of trees come down, a lot of their wood may be naturally rot resistant and may make great natural raised bed frames. Build a couple of them to begin with and start gardening slow, because your time is going to be limited. You're going to have a lot to do in and around the house, but make sure you have the room to expand. Add a couple of raised beds every year and you'll be much happier and you won't get exhausted that first year.
That sounds like a good plan.
All right. Well, good luck on your great adventure, Carlotta.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And maybe I can give you an update next year.
Absolutely. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind our festive fans that those cute little rosemary trees are always root-bound and need to be repotted into larger containers to survive. That you should never let the reservoir run dry under a cut Christmas tree. To take good care of amaryllis leaves if you want to attempt rebloom. And that poinsettias are tropical plants that should never be exposed to the cold outdoors. But don't go looking for all the details at the A to Z Answers section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to use seaweed to improve the health of your plants. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, seaweed. What should you do if you find a pile of weeds from the sea on a beach somewhere? We'll tell you in the question of the week. Otherwise, it's a fascinating phone call show. Cats and kittens, you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Hamid, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Hamid. How are you, sir?
Very well, sir. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Where are you?
I'm in Fairfax, Virginia.
Just outside of Washington, D.C.
That's correct.
All right. What can we do for Hamid near our nation's capital?
Well, we have done some construction in our garden, and we have about 7-8 large trees around, and we managed to save them all because I love those trees and I don't want to lose them. But in a matter of years, it just seems like they're not as strong. They have some bugs and fleas in them, and they have a whole bunch of fungus on them. So I was just wondering how it can improve their quality so we can enjoy them for a long time to come.
So you did some construction, and it impacted the roots of trees behind your house.
Yes, that's true.
And when was the construction done?
It was done in 2006, 2007.
Okay, so it's been quite a while. And have you...
It has been some time.
Have you noticed a steady decline, or is this sudden?
Yeah, it has been sort of a steady decline. Like, one of them was two pieces on the tree, and one of the legs, we had to cut it down because it was just keep rotting away.
Right.
So we tend to keep the other leg. But there's one on the side that just has a lot of fleas and worms in it, and so I was hoping to try some sort of a natural way to preserve them and just bring them back to full bloom.
Are they growing out of a lawn?
Yes.
Is the lawn treated? Does a lawn care company come by and treat it with weed killers?
Not at all, no.
Oh, I'll excellent.
Take care of them, and I put some compost on it, and I just shred the grass and put it around. I shred the leaves to mulch it, mm-hmm. keep the leaves on the ground on the back, so make it just nice and earthy.
Oh, okay, good, good, good. So you have some rotten branches, some branches that have green fungus on them.
That's right.
And
even on the trunk of it, on the big trunks, I see some green fungus all around it now.
All around. Yeah, you know, there's an old saying here that it's always okay to see moss on the north side of a tree. But obviously
right.
you shouldn't see moss going all the way around a tree.
Actually, now you mention it, it's mostly on the north side.
Well, that could be absolutely normal, man. Don't forget that that's where the most shade hits. That's the coldest part of the tree. When I was a kid growing up, and before I got kicked out of Boy Scouts, that was one of the first lessons they taught you. If you were if you were lost in the woods and you didn't have your compass and you were as dumb as I was, you could look and... And you could figure out north by seeing moss growing on like four or five trees. If it was all on
right.
one side, that's where north was. So that's common. Now, what disturbs me is you say that there's insect infestations. You say you've seen, quote, worms, which means there's caterpillars.
Correct.
Anytime we use the word worm to describe an agricultural pest, that's a caterpillar. And there's common caterpillar pests in stressed trees, fall webworms, which make big visible nests in late mm-hmm. in the season. And then there are tent caterpillars that make big visible nests early in the season in the spring. Have you seen either of those?
I have seen on the small branches on nesting on like in the springtime.
Mm-hmm. This is the perfect time of year to have a certified arborist go up into the trees and take out any dead, decayed, or dying wood. This is the absolute perfect time, and it's really easy to remember. If you don't want to be outside, it's the perfect time to prune big trees. So there's no harm in having the trees thinned out and cleaned up at this time of year. And then in the spring, there is an organic insecticide that only works against caterpillars called BT. And the arborist will probably know it by its biggest brand name, Dipel. It's widely available. It's been around 40, 50 years. You spray it on the trees, and then the only creatures who are harmed are caterpillars that chew on the leaves. It doesn't harm birds. It doesn't harm frogs and toads. Are the trees leafing out normally in the spring?
Yes, mostly yes.
I would say then a couple of sprays of BT early in the season, and I think you're going to see a remarkable improvement.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. I'll keep listening to your program. I enjoy it very much. Thanks for your help.
Thank you, sir. You take care.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, Joan. Where are you?
I'm in beautiful Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
It is a beautiful area. Actually, Bucks County is a big area, but I'll presume you're in a beautiful spot. You've never lied to me before that I
can remember. No, never. I live on the canal.
Oh, okay. Very good. Because they used to have recreations of when the mules would pull the barges up the canal to take goods from shore to shore.
Yep.
All right. What can we do for Joan in Bucks County?
Okay. My next door neighbor planted bamboo.
Okay. Now, you should move.
I beg him.
You should move quickly.
Well, that's what I was worried about. I begged him. I said, there's clumping, because I learned everything I learned is from you. There's clumping and
running.
The other, running. He planted both, mm-hmm. even though I begged him not to. But so now I'm concerned because I see it's been about 3 years, and I see these little trails and some bamboo, little baby bamboo is growing up. So
on your property?
Almost.
Okay. So what you got to do, I don't know who's going to pay for it, but the only way to keep the bamboo on his side reliably is to have a landscaper who knows what they're doing come dig a trench and install what's called rhizome barrier. Now, the resource you mostly want, go to our A to Z answer section and read the articles on bamboo. And the best information you're going to get is at a website called AmericanBamboo.org. These are people who love bamboo, mostly the well-behaved clumping varieties, but they also have great advice, very professional advice for containing running bamboo, which is a dangerously invasive plant because it can actually undermine foundations.
Well, that's what I was worried about. And he said the landscaper planted a 6-foot barrier.
Oh, okay. We should find out where that barrier is.
I have to find out where it is. I know who the. I mean, they've done a beautiful job. But
okay. It's quite possible that his bamboo will then stay inside the equivalent of a bathtub, which is how a friend of mine planted bamboo. He sunk an old claw-style bathtub into the ground, took out the plug so it would drain, had the lip above ground, and he put running bamboo in it, and it just stays there.
Wow, but what about the roots that grow out on top, like very superficially? Do I have to worry about those?
The rhizome barrier should have a visible lip.
Oh, there should be a visible lip.
Above ground to prevent that. But if there's a rhizome barrier in the ground, and all that you have to worry about is the occasional rogue rhizome trying to, like, crawl across the, you know, Maginot line on its belly.
That's what I was seeing, yes, and I got freaked out.
No. The parapruners, a heavy-duty weed whacker.
Fine, okay.
It's the underground rhizomes because, for instance, when you look at his clump of running bamboo, the important thing to remember is that in reality, you see all those different culms coming up out of the ground. You might tell somebody, he's got 50 or 100 plants. In reality, that's one plant. Those are like the branches of a tree.
I see.
And it's all growing out of this incredibly matted, powerful root structure that looks, when you dig it up, frighteningly like the original Alien in the Ridley Scott movie. It has that same kind of structure to it. Now, in the state of Virginia, the Supreme Court has ruled that people who plant invasive plants that cause damage on other people's property are responsible. And that's the applicable case law right now, even though it was decided in Virginia. Until a higher court says otherwise, that's the precedent. So he has a fiscal responsibility as well as a moral one to keep that on his side. Worst comes to worst, somebody may have to pound simple edging into the ground around the rhizome barrier to prevent this. You might be able to go out and buy foot-high plastic edging that you can put in that'll just make sure it always goes back on his side.
Okay, it's a kind of a raised bed, and there's a stone wall between his property and my property, maybe 2 feet high.
Right. Well, the wall, it depends on how low it goes, how deep the foundation of the wall is. Stone walls often do stop bamboo. Strike up a good conversation with the homeowner, ask him when the landscaper's coming out, or ask if you can call the landscaper out and just have the rhizome barrier checked. It sounds like they may have done this completely correctly.
Okay, very, very good. I wish you a great winter. There's lots of snow.
Well, you know, actually, lots of snow, if it's cold, is better than a cold winter with no snow. It's much better for your plants.
Oh, good. That's good to know.
All right, Joan, you take care.
You too, Mike. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-553-7262. 800-346-9499. Alan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thank you very much. Glad to join you. I'm glad to be on the program.
I'm glad to have you, Alan. Where are you?
I'm in Delaware County, just outside Philadelphia.
Okay, very good, sir. Proceed.
So, here's what I'm thinking about. Delaware County, I'm pretty close in suburb, but nonetheless, remarkably, I live in a little patch of woods.
Right.
And I have a, I guess you'd call it a yard, that's cleared, though it doesn't get much sun. I've maintained it since I lived here for about 6 years, hoping it would be a meadow, but it's been getting taken over by this stuff I call garlic mustard.
Ooh, now wait a minute. Is it a bulbing plant, like a little baby onion or garlic, or is it a green plant that when you pick it or play with it, it smells like garlic?
Well, it's a green, close-to-the-ground, broad-leafed plant.
Oh, man.
It has pretty little flowers in the springtime, but otherwise just spreads and kills everything else.
This is one of the most notorious invasive plants because its roots secrete a chemical that reduce the plant competition in the area. So this is one, you know, not with herbicides, but with flame weeders and herbicidal soaps and iron. This is a plant that you are more than welcome to attack and hold back if you want to try to establish something else.
Well, and that was part one of my question, back locally, right on what you spray it.
Man, that's a human hormonal disruptor that kills amphibians by the millions. What you can do is you can buy something called the water-powered weeder. That's a long spike you jam into the ground and attach to your garden hose, and it shoots the bad plants out of the ground, roots and all. Use that when the soil is wet. You can get a propane-powered flame weeder and torch the tops of the plants to kill them. That works best when the soil is bone dry and it's hot out. You can buy herbicidal soaps that you spray on the plant and smother them. There are new herbicides made with an active ingredient that's a form of iron that are very effective on broadleaf plants like that. So you have a lot of organic options.
Okay, good. I will find an option like that. Then once I eliminate that stuff, what I'd like to do is establish something that's friendly to butterflies and bees.
Okay.
So I know monarchs love milkweed.
Right.
I don't know how that does in the shade, though.
Well, see, one of the problems is bees are only going to come for flowers. And
right. You
don't get a lot of flowering plants in the shade. So if you want a bee-friendly garden, you may have to clear a little area or something like that. But bees and shade don't really go along, except a shady area is a great place to put a beehive. But bees can travel quite long distances. And in addition to any bees that might be in the area from your local beekeepers, there's lots of native bees. But they need flowers. They need flowers that produce lots of nectar and pollen, and they like big blocks of them. Bees are attracted to big blocks of color. And then if they see a big block of color and it's a nice pollen and nectar producer, they'll come in droves. Butterflies, the interesting thing, you mentioned milkweed for monarchs. Well, the adult monarch doesn't need the milkweed plant. The butterfly doesn't need the milkweed plant. Milkweed is a host plant for the monarch caterpillar. So you don't have to worry about...
We need that to get more monarchs.
Exactly. Exactly.
In general,
And a lot of people enjoy looking at these caterpillars, which are pretty crazy looking, pretty wildly colored and everything, because they're trying to warn birds that they're theoretically poisonous, that they've taken this toxin in through the milkweed plant. But there's even garden crops you can grow that don't need a lot of sunlight that are very butterfly-friendly as host plants. Carrots, parsley, the parsley worm butterfly, is absolutely beautiful. Turns into this fabulous swallowtail. So the more sun, obviously, the better you're going to do. Because especially if you need adult butterflies, you need some sunlight so you can have like a butterfly bush out there so all the adult butterflies come for the pollen and nectar. You know, there are a few plants that are so well known as attractors that they're named after the insect. Bee balm, for instance, B-A-L-M, B-E-E, B-A-L-M, is like the number one plant for attracting bees. Butterfly bush is the number one plant for attracting butterflies. But you'll find lots of them. It sounds like your main task is to get rid of as much of this garlic mustard and find some sunny areas. By the way, especially early in the spring, the garlic mustard is totally edible. It's not bad for you at all. Matter of fact, it's an incredibly nutritious springtime herb. It's just really bad for other plants.
Well, there you go. Before I kill it, I'll consume it.
If you go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org and go to Garden Answers A to Z under both butterflies and bees, we do have great lists of plants that attract both, so you can work with that.
Well, that's great advice.
All right, good
and
luck.
I will work on it, and thank you very much for having me.
All right. Happy to have you had, Alan. Good luck, sir.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners that the first poinsettia displayed in the United States was at the very first Philadelphia Flower Show back in 1829. More to the point, a holiday membership in the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society makes a great last-minute gift for a gardener and includes tickets to the next show in March with special member perks like use of the members-only lounge that's so classy they always ask me to leave. But don't you go looking for all the details. Are you ready? At theflowershow.org just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how seaweed can improve the health of your plants. I'm Healthy Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will answer the question of the week. Is seaweed good for the garden? How do you use it? What about the salt? And where does the seagrass that grows down in many areas of the intracoastal waterway fit in? We'll answer those burning questions after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Leah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Leah. How are you?
I'm good.
And where is Leah good?
In Bowlesburg, Pennsylvania.
I have no idea where that is.
Oh, it's right outside of State College.
Oh, boy. I tell you, you State College people are great participators ever since we went on the air there.
Oh, great.
We've heard from so many of you. It's wonderful.
Oh, good. Yeah, we love your show.
Oh, thank you very much. What can we do for Leah in Bowlesburg?
Well, in the summer, I bought a lemon tree to be indoor in the winter, and I was going to take it out in the summer, but I bought it in the middle of summer, and it's been inside the whole time. But I noticed that it had scale, those little hard-shelled things,
right?
They're scale. And I went to the garden store, and I bought this. It's called Garden Safe Insecticidal Soap.
Okay.
And I sprayed that on, and it said I could do it once a week or even twice a week. And I did it three times, and it didn't look so great. So then I looked up on your website, which I should have done first, and you did say to use insecticidal soap, but you said to wash it off.
Yes.
And that's what I didn't do.
And it didn't tell you to do that on the package either.
It didn't tell me to do that.
No one else will tell you to do it.
But do you think because it looks kind of like maybe I killed it, but do you think it's because I didn't wash it off? It says for organic gardening on it.
Right, right. So you may have killed it organically. That would be a plus. Good for you, Leah. No, no. Did you spray it on the leaves or just on the trunk?
I sprayed it on the leaves, and it said to soak them, but then I saw the scale on the trunk.
Okay.
So I sprayed it on the trunk, and now that I look at the scale, they do kind of look dead, so I probably did kill them.
Okay, good. Well, you know, we might be one and one, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe everything's dead. But after you read my warning, I presume you rinsed the tree down very well.
Well, I didn't because I've got it in this huge ceramic thing that's really heavy. I can't even get it in the shower. So I couldn't take it outside. It was too cold.
Right.
And I couldn't get it to a shower, but that's what I would have needed to have done, right?
Or with a mister, a sprayer.
Oh.
That just has plain water in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, depending on where in the house you are, you may have to be clever.
Yeah.
And, like, hang some newspaper or cardboard or a blanket behind it or something like that. But you get, like, a little hand sprayer that's never held chemicals of any kind or a little
mm-hmm.
pressurized sprayer. Heck, or even a dollar store mister is better than nothing.
Okay, yeah, I have them for the iron.
And you keep misting the plant leaves.
Okay.
I will tell you that indoor citrus loves to be misted.
Anyway.
Yes,
uh-huh.
Exactly. So it's only good for it. These are pretty hardy plants. How many times did you spray it, Leah?
I sprayed it three times.
Oh, I think we're alive. I think we're alive. We're just unhappy. I mean, nobody's
okay.
happy right now. We've had way too much snow. It's been too cold. Everybody's in a bad mood, and I think your lemon tree is there, too. I want you to mist it every morning. We want to make sure all that soap residue is out of there. Keep it really well watered, and I predict with the conditions it's in, I think you're going to see new green growth on it. I don't think it's dead.
Okay, great, 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 great. Okay.
Good. All right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, good luck, Leah.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Neil, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing good, Neil. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Where is Neil doing okay?
In Boyertown, Pennsylvania. North of Philly, south of Allentown and Reading.
Okay, Boyertown is famous for a candy company, aren't they?
There is one. I can't think of the name offhand, but it is. It's a family company, and it is popular.
We'll figure it out sometime.
Yeah.
Yes. After we hang up, we'll both remember it. What can we do for Neil in Boyertown?
Okay, here's what's going on. I have extensive gardens incorporating cannas, lilies, dahlias, castor beans, cleomys, and a variety of annuals and perennials. I always liked cleomys and found them to be really easy to grow and resistant until this past summer. During August, I noticed on my cleomys what I thought were juvenile brown marmorated stink bugs,
mm-hmm.
Which are a big problem in this area. And as juveniles, the brown stink bugs have some orange color, so that's just what I thought they were. They're a major problem here, but don't do too much damage to flowers. Well, after about 1 to 2 weeks, I noticed my cleomys, which are always healthy, turning brown and dying. Upon closer inspection, I noticed that they were fully encrusted with an orange and black bug that was the size of a stink bug, but it definitely was not a stink bug. Went online and found out that I had a major infestation of a harlequin bug, which I've never seen in all my years of gardening in this area.
They are around here. Harlequin bugs are more pestiferous down south. They're much more used to them. down south, so much so that they don't call them stink bugs. They are in the gigantic stink bug family, and as you found out, they stink when you crush them, just like a marmorated stink bug. So they are essentially very similar pests, but as you note, they will go after flowers, whereby the marmorated are generally pests of fruits like peaches and tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. Well, the cleomys were absolutely beyond repair, and I probably removed 30 full-grown plants that were just encrusted with these harlequin bugs. Unfortunately, once I did that, they then spread to just about everything else, primarily my dahlias. I just let it go, and after the first hard frost, I dug everything up in terms of getting rid of all the foliage, and then digging up my cana bulbs, my dahlias, and they're now being stored in my basement.
Right.
I've composted my beds with crushed leaves, and now I'm just thinking, in preparation for next year, I guess I have two main questions. I'm sure these bugs are in the soil. I believe they can overwinter, and now they have a nice bed of leaves over the flower bed, so they're probably sleeping well in there. But I'm also wondering if, by bringing the bulbs in, can these harlequin bugs, like, lay eggs or overwinter, you know, in between the bulbs or within the bulbs themselves?
I do not believe so. I do not believe there is a pest called the narcissus fly that does this. And there is a pest of iris rhizomes, an iris borer, that does complete its life cycle inside the bulb or the rhizome. But that's not what stink bugs do. We're just going to use the generic term stink bug.
Okay.
My understanding is the adults will either lay eggs or overwinter in garden debris and nearby weeds. So as much as I'm a fan of protecting the soil, you might want to rake up, if you get an opportunity over the winter, rake up that leaf cover, those shredded leaves you put over top of your beds, hope that snow will replace it. And then what I would do is I would combine that shredded leaf material with a lot of coffee grounds and make compost and cook it up at the same time. Fresh horse manure would do the same thing.
Okay.
And that would kill any overwintering adults or eggs. Now, in a normal season, do you feed these plants?
No, I have. I bring in mushroom soil. I do have a big pile of manure on my property, and I use a lot of compost, so I do it all naturally.
Okay, what kind of manure?
It's horse manure.
Okay, and you're not feeding that to these bulbs, are you?
My entire beds get horse manure mixed in the soil.
Okay, it's time to stop that now.
Okay.
Horse manure is not a complete nutrient. It is very nitrogen-rich, which grows big plants, but it can inhibit flowering. And it can make the plants grow as big as a chemical fertilizer and as fast, which makes it more attractive to pests.
Hmm.
Your flowering bulbs and your cleomys and whatever else you have out there wants a nice balanced fertilizer. Do you use anything to mulch the plants after all this is over?
I do. I just get some mulch, and then that goes down and spread that out around the
wood mulch
of the flowers. I'm using, yes, wood mulch. Mm-hmm.
Forget it. Don't do it again, because that weakens the plants, that attracts these beetles. There's like three things you're doing now that are luring the beetles to your plants.
Hmm.
So here's your options when these pests first show up.
Yes.
When they first show up, I would try an insecticidal soap. I would get a pre-made insecticidal soap in a hip garden center. I would spray it directly on these little pests when they're young, when I can see them, early in the morning, and then an hour later I would rinse it all off the plant, because
okay.
It works by smothering. Your alternative would be a light summer spray horticultural oil, not a dormant oil, but a similar to the soap. It coats the pests and suffocates them, but you have to hit the pest to get them. Now, there are a couple of organic insecticides that you can use that are very safe on you, but unfortunately, they're toxic for bees.
And I'm a beekeeper, too.
You don't want to be using spinosad or anything like that. But I tell you what, if we change a little bit of your habits here and get any early in the season, That should take care of things. Oh, and be sure to hang suet feeders in the area now.
Okay.
To bring in birds, because birds will eat these stink bugs.
They do eat them, okay.
Yes.
Well, I have my list of things to do.
All right, man.
Thank you very much for your advice, Mike. I love your show.
Good luck, Neil.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Feeding your soil with seaweed. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden. We got two questions this week. Would you please begin by reading us the foist?
Well, Mike, we heard from another Mike who lives in Fort Pierce, Florida, who writes, how can we make plant food from seaweed? We have an unlimited supply of a type called seagrass. It comes from the Indian River, which is part of the intracoastal waterway on the east coast of Florida. It seems the stuff should work. The sea cows eat it, so I would be surprised if it wasn't of use in the garden.
Well, seagrass isn't seaweed, Mike. It does grow in submerged saline environments, but otherwise it's much more like a terrestrial lawn than an underwater plant. It only grows in water that's shallow and still enough to allow it to photosynthesize, and its amazingly thorough Wikipedia entry adds that it even pollinates underwater. Those big, silly-looking manatees do graze on it, as do a number of other aquatic species. And it does have history as a fertilizer. The Portuguese, who called it molico, once collected seagrass to enhance their sandy soil.
And being in Florida, it's likely that our listener also has sandy soil, right?
Yeah, but I wouldn't suggest he harvest any of his molico. The Wiki article goes to great lengths to explain how this grass is an integral part of a very complex ecosystem that supports an amazing biodiversity. Wiki also reports that these underwater meadows slow down ocean currents and capture sediment, protecting local residents by breaking the strength of waves and preventing erosion.
Well, these grasses certainly sound important.
And they're in decline around the world, so it doesn't sound like something we should harvest. But I wouldn't hesitate to add any that washed up out of the water to my compost pile.
Well, we also heard from Bob, who, quote, lives near the coast of Maine. He writes, in a previous program, you mentioned adding seaweed to shredded leaves for composting. What type of seaweed can be used? And does it need to be rinsed to remove salt before use?
Now, this is a plant of a different color. As soon as we heard from Bob, I called my dear friends Elliot Coleman and Barbara Damarosh, whose new book, The Four Season Farm Gardener's Cookbook, celebrates their amazing success as true four-season growers half a mile away from the ocean in Maine, and their love of cooking and eating what they grow.
Oh, wow, you've told me in the past that they're the real deal. I can't imagine growing for market over the winter in Maine.
It really is a four-season farm. And I knew that they use seaweed, which is locally abundant on their chilly coast. Barbara told me that after a storm, they'd just drive down to the water, and if a batch had washed up, they'd cart it all home.
Straight from the beach?
Actually, she said there's a little road just off the ocean where huge batches of it wash up, so they rush to get it while it's still nice and fresh.
Do they wash the salt off?
Nope, and they never have. Elliot says it just never seemed that salty, and he's been using it for decades without seeing any problems. Just the reverse, in fact, as he credits it with supplying the minerals and micronutrients that are so essential for healthy, natural plants. Elliot told me he feels that there are three keys to healthy soil. Organic matter, the importance of which we stress every week on this show. Air in the soil, which is a topic we really should address more. And minerals, which we mostly talk about when we recommend adding rock dust to the soil, while Elliot depends on seaweed. He calls it, quote, his insurance policy against micronutrient plant deficiencies.
Well, how exactly does he use it?
He says he adds some to his compost piles, but he explains that they get the most reliable wash-ups in the fall. And when that abundance comes in, he spreads the collected seaweed directly on his soil, lets it break down over the winter, and then tills it in the spring.
Yeah, but you don't advocate tilling.
I also don't advocate a backyard gardener with a loud voice telling a hugely successful farmer, writer, and organic advocate what to do. And Elliot has always seemed to be able to break the rules and still succeed. Maybe the weeds that tilling is supposed to cause are scared of him. At any rate, the line that really got me was when he said, "If I didn't live near the coast, seaweed or kelp is the only input I would buy." Now, that's really high praise from one of the masters of sustainable closed-loop farming.
But he'd have to buy a seaweed product, right?
Well, apparently there are sources of bulk seaweed. But Barbara told me that she once investigated the harvesting and processing of the kelp that's used in organic fertilizers and was very impressed with its sustainability. Most, if not all, of the commercial product comes from the North Sea, where there are protections against over-harvesting. And the finished product is dried using energy from naturally occurring thermal vents in the sea. How cool is that?
It's really cool.
Well, that sure was some good information about weeds from the sea, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to fertilize my flora with chicken of the sea if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please put the subject in the subject line and
please, please, please tell us where you live. Please. Oh, it's so important.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out what's new every day at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. We bid a fond farewell this week to our production assistant, Effie Kong. Effie, we hardly knew you. Still stuck here in the land that time forgot are our editor, Al Banks, Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, and your nautical horticultural host, Mike McGrath. I'll set sail for 2,500 miles south-southwest of Sumatra and curse this fog. See you. It's time for all good gardeners to go ho, ho, ho. That's H-O-E, of course. I'm Mike McGrath, and the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden is our annual Christmas spectacular with songs, stories, and lots of holiday plant lore.